Welcome to the Hackberry House of Chosun. My name is Bob, reading today from the Free Grace Broadcaster, the series we've had on Sermon Audio for quite some time now. It comes every quarter to my house, free, and it can come to your house too, by the way. Just get in touch with chapellibrary.org. That's two L's in the middle, chapellibrary.org. Or write to them at chapel@mountzion.org. And they will send this to you free, every quarter. And it's a combination of old voices, but good voices, on a particular subject. This time it's Spurgeon and Watson and Swinnick and Owen and Pink and people that we've had on here before. And the topic is meditation, godly meditation, not the kind that the world talks about. Charles Spurgeon starts us out with this one in 1834. Well, he lived from 1834 to 1892 and gave this, I'm not sure if it was a talk or a writing, but a very profitable exercise is the name of it. And he uses Psalm 104, verse 34, "My meditation of him shall be sweet." Meditation is a word that more than half of you, I fear, do not know how to spell. Now, you know how to repeat the letters of the word, but I mean to say you cannot spell it in the reality of life. You do not occupy yourselves with any meditation. What do many of you who are merchants know concerning this matter? You rise up in the morning just in time to take your accustomed seat in the omnibus. We call it the bus today. You hasten to your counting house for your letters, and there you continue all day long for business when you are busy or for gossip when business is dull. And at night you go home too tired and jaded for the wholesome recreation of your minds. Week by week, month by month, year by year, it's still with you, one everlasting grind, grind, grind. You have no time for meditation. And you reckon, perhaps, that if you were to set apart half an hour in the day to ponder the weighty matters of eternity, it would be to you a clear loss of time. It's very wise of you to economize your minutes, but I suppose that if half an hour in a day could earn you £100, you wouldn't say that you could not afford it because you know how to estimate pecuniary profit. Now, if you equally knew how to count the great profit of meditation, you would deem it a positive gain to yourselves to spend some time therein. For meditation is most profitable to the spirit. It's an extremely healthful and excellent occupation. Far from being wasted time, it's a judicious employment of time. Do not imagine that the meditative man is necessarily lazy. Contrarywise, he lays the best foundation for useful works. He's not the best student who reads the most books, but he who meditates the most upon them. He shall not learn most of divinity who hears the greatest number of sermons, but he who meditates the most devoutly upon what he does hear. Nor shall he be so profound a scholar who takes down ponderous volumes one after the other as he who, reading little by little, precept upon precept, line upon line, digests what he reads and assimilates each sentiment to his heart by meditation, receiving the word first into his understanding and afterwards receiving the spirit of it into his own soul. Meditation is thus a very excellent employment. Let me for a few minutes tell you some of its uses. First, I think meditation furnishes the mind somewhat with rest. It's the couch of the soul. The time that a man spends in necessary rest, he never reckons to be wasted because he's refreshing and renovating himself for further exertion. Meditation, then, is the rest of the spirit. "Oh," says one, I must have rest. Here I've been toiling incessantly for months. I've got to have a day's excursion. I've got to do this and that and the other." Yes, and such recreation in its proper place is desirable. We ought to have seasons of innocent recreation. But at the same time, if many of us knew how to spend a little time daily in the calm repose of contemplative retirement, we should find ourselves less exhausted by the wear and tear of our worldly duties. To meditate would be to us a salutary recreation, and instead of running ourselves out of breath and laboring until a respite is compulsory, we should spread our intervals of ease and refreshing over the whole year and secure a small portion every day by turning aside from the bustling crowd to meditate upon whatever subject we wish to occupy the most honorable place in our mind. And just as a change of posture relieves the weariness of the body, a change of thoughts will prevent your spirits becoming languid. Sit down in a silent chamber at eventide, throw the window up, look at God's bright stars, and count those eyes of heaven. Or, if you like it better, pause in the noontide heat, look down upon the busy crowd in the streets, and count the men like so many ants upon the anthill of this world. Or if you care not to look about you, sit down and look within yourself. Count the pulses of your own heart. Examine the emotions of your own breast. At times, it's well to muse upon heaven. Or if thou art a man loving to revel in the prophetic future, turn over the mystic page and study the sacred visions recorded in the book of Daniel or the book of Revelation. As thou dost enter these hallowed intricacies and dost meditate upon these impressive symbols, thou wilt rise from thy study mightily refreshed. You'll find it like a couch to your mind. Again, meditation is the machine in which the raw material of knowledge is converted to the best uses. Let me compare it to a wine press. By reading, research, and study, we gather the grapes. But it is by meditation that we press out the juice of those grapes and obtain the wine. How is it that many men who read very much know very little? The reason is they read a large, heavy, scholarly book, and they stow away knowledge with heavy confusion inside their heads until they've laid so much weight on their brain that it cannot work. Instead of putting facts into the press of meditation and fermenting them until they can draw out right inferences, they leave them to rot and perish. They extract none of the sweet juice of wisdom from the precious fruits of the vine. And when I've read a book for about a half an hour, I like to walk a while and think it over. I shut up the volume and I say, "Now, Mr. Author, you made your speech. Let me think over what you've said." A little meditation will enable me to distinguish between what I knew before and the fresh subject that you've communicated to me, between your facts and your opinions, between your arguments and those I should make from the same premises. Animals, after they have eaten, they lie down and ruminate. They first crop the grass and afterwards digest it. And so meditation is the rumination of the soul. Thereby we get that nourishment that feeds and supports the mind. When thou hast gathered flowers in the field or garden, arrange them in proper order. Bind them together with a string of memory. But take heed that thou dost put them into the water of meditation, else they will soon fade and be fit only for the dunghill. When thou hast gathered pearls from the sea, recollect that thou wilt have gathered with them many worthless shells and much mud. Therefore sort them in thy memory, and only keep those that are worth preserving. Thou must also open the oyster to extract the pearl, and polish it to make it appear more beautiful. Thou mayest not string it in the necklace of thy mind until it has been rubbed and garnished by meditation. Thus you see that we need meditation to make use of what we have discovered. As it is the rest of the soul, so it is at the same time the means of making the best use of what the soul has acquired. Again, meditation is to the soul what oil was to the body of the wrestlers. When those old athletes went out to wrestle, they always took care before they went to oil themselves well, to make their joints supple and fit for their task. Now, meditation makes the soul supple, makes it so that it can use things when they come into the mind. Who are the men that can go into a controversy and get the mastery? Why, the men who meditate when they're alone. Who are the men that can preach? Not those who gad about and never commune with their own hearts alone, but those who think earnestly as well when no one is near them as when there's a crowd around them. Who are the authors that write your books and keep up the constant supply of literature? They are meditative men. They keep their bones supple and their limbs fit for exercise by continually bathing themselves in the oil of meditation. How important, therefore, is meditation as a mental exercise to have our minds in constant readiness for any service. I've thus pointed out to you that meditation is useful to every man. As meditation is good for the mind, even upon worldly topics and natural science, much more is it useful when we come to spiritual learning. The best and most saintly of men have been men of meditation. Isaac went out into the fields at eventide to meditate. David says, "I will meditate in thy statutes." Paul, who himself meditated continually on all that related to the gospel, writing to Timothy concerning the important things needful in a good minister of Jesus Christ, says, "Meditate upon these things. Give thyself wholly to them, that thy profiting may appear to all." To the Christian, meditation is most essential. I should almost question the being of a Christian, and I should positively deny his well-being, who lived habitually without meditation. Meditation and prayer are twin sisters, and both appear to me equally necessary to Christian life. I think meditation must exist where there is prayer, and prayer is sure to exist where there is meditation. My brethren, there's nothing more lacking to make Christians grow in grace nowadays than meditation. Most of you are painfully negligent in this matter. How often do you, through lack of meditation, miss the entire purpose for which a sermon was designed? Unless you meditate upon the truths we declare to you, you will gather little sweetness, you will acquire little profit, and certainly you'll be in no wise established therein to your edification. Can you get the honey from the comb until you press it? You may be refreshed while you listen to the sermon, but it is the meditation afterwards that extracts the honey and gets the best and most luscious savor therefrom. Let me tell you that there ought to be special times for meditation. I think every man should set apart a portion of each day for this gracious exercise. A Christian will ever be in a lean state if he has no time for sacred musings before his God. Those men who know most of God are such as meditate most upon him. Those who realize most experimentally the doctrines of grace are those who meditate and soar beyond the reach of all sublunary thinking. I think we shall never have much advancement in our churches until the members thereof begin to accept habitually the counsel, "Come, my people, enter thou into thy chambers and shut thy doors about thee," Isaiah 26:20. Or that other, "Commune with your own heart upon your bed and be still," Psalm 4:4. Until the din and noise of business somewhat abate, and we give ourselves to calmer thought, and in the solemn silence of the mind find at once our heaven and our God, we must expect to have regiments of dwarfs, and only here and there a giant. Giant minds cannot be nourished by mere casual hearing. Gigantic souls must have meditation to support them. Would you be strong? Would you be mighty? Would you be valiant for the Lord and useful in his cause? Take care that you follow the occupation of the psalmist David and meditate. This is a very happy and very profitable exercise. Amen. Now that was actually from a sermon, I see here now, from a sermon delivered at New Park Street Chapel in Southwark in England on a Thursday evening in the summer of 1858 by Charles Spurgeon, and I think you know who he was. God bless you for being here today. There's a lot more on this website. If you take a long look, you'll find a lot of things. I hope you'll do that. This is the Hackberry House of Chosun. Lord willing, we will talk soon. Bye-bye.